People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, from overcoming challenges like experiencing homelessness as a youth in Thunder Bay, to learning about traditional plant medicines and family history from her grandfather, Crystal Toop shares some of the journey that led her to start Blackbird Medicines, where she now supports Indigenous people training to be end-of-life doulas. Welcome to People First Radio. Crystal Toop is the founder of Blackbird Medicines. It's a cultural wellness practice that, among other things, offers a free end-of-life doula training designed for and by Indigenous people. Toop had initially been working as a birth doula. When her grandfather was going through chemotherapy, he ended up teaching Toop about plant medicines that could help him. He also shared more about their family history. Toop says the experience got her more interested in end-of-life doula work. You'll hear Crystal Toop share that story later on today's show, but we began by talking about youth, both the message she's hoping to pass on to the next generations of nurses and police officers, and the journey she went through as a young person that led her to the work she's doing today.
Bonjour, Nindishnikas, Dabajmu Benisi, Seisega Banoji Dorum, Makwa Dorum Pekwaknagan. So my traditional name is Story Healing Thunderbird, and I'm a member of the Evening Grosbeak clan. And I'm an Anishinaabe, European mixed identity person from the Algonquins of Pekwaknagan First Nation. I live on my unceded ancestral territory in what's also known as Renfrew County in Ontario, just a little north of Ottawa. And I'm a person with a lot of hats, a lot of titles, but overall I consider myself a helper, a mom, an auntie, a wife, and Australian Shepherd Wrangler most times. So... That's me.
Well, thank you again for making some time to speak with me. Recently on the program, we heard from Susan Srigley. She's a deaf educator and a professor at Nipissing University. And you go and visit her classes and speak with the students there. What's the message that you're trying to communicate with those young people about death and dying?
Oh, my visits with Susan's class are probably some of my favorite opportunities, those speaking, storytelling opportunities. Susan has this class of really, you know, diverse, different students of different, you know, programs and things like that, nurses and criminal justice folks and police foundations. And really, I try to bring in some of my lived experience and some of the things that I have to navigate as a helper for people who are dying, people who are accessing healthcare. For Indigenous folks, accessing healthcare can mean dying. And so you see a lot of things that kind of stem off from that reality. So that's what I try and bring to her students. We have a tendency to talk about things in this country in a way that everything was past tense, while things are very much happening in the present. So that's a little bit of what I help those students practice, is to think about what's happening now, giving them some practical skills of to go further, ways to learn more, and also ways to be supportive, ways to be allies in the spaces that they're occupying with their careers. And we're really, I think it's really exciting that these, you know, young people, university, college, there's all kinds of mixes of people. They're not all, you know, fresh out of high school sort of thing. And it's just an amazing opportunity to connect with people before they, you know, take that heart work for why they're in that program and going out there. And so many folks now are being raised with more education around Indigenous issues and history than ever before. It's a really special, unprecedented time in that way. So people are very receptive, and I get to come in and just talk nonstop for 2 hours, and they just love it for some crazy reason. So I'm lucky that way.
As we go through our conversation today, are there any parts of the journey that brought you into doing this work that you'd like people to be aware of?
Well, I think for myself, and it's certainly been the trend with the people that I'm training and engaging with, we come into this with lived expertise. For myself, like many people, one of my first experiences with death and loss was with losing pets and grandparents. And certainly losing my grandmother right after I became a young mother was really, really, it shaped me in many ways that I didn't have the benefit of understanding until I had some time to reflect on it 20 years later. So, you know, losing my grandmother is something that I wrote a lot about in a collaborative book project. It's called Bold Spirit for the Dying. And there was a second follow-up book called Tender Truths for the Dying. And in that one, I shared a bit of my own experience as someone who grew up with, you know, adverse childhood effects and, you know, labels like youth at risk. I spent time as a homeless youth on the streets. I was very transient growing up because of the poverty my family experienced, often relocating from one end of the province to another. So there's a lot of, I guess, challenges that I've overcome in my life. And one of the crazy things that I got as feedback in Susan's class was she was shocked at the different, I guess, challenges I've overcome in a short time from being a teenager and things like that. So, but that's really the reality, I think, for a lot of folks, not everyone, but certainly I didn't grow up with the understanding of how residential school impacted my family. It was actually a secret until probably, you know, it was something that nobody in our family knew about until a few years ago. So there's a lot there. And yeah, there's so many ways that I've been shaped by this work, whether it was by the people that I met and saw pass away from street life for different reasons, whether it was drug related, violence. And then those things moved on as my personal way of living in the world changed, so too did my experiences around death and dying. So, yeah, lots there.
You're listening to People First Radio. Today on the show, we're hearing from Crystal Toop. She's the founder of Blackbird Medicines. Some of her work with the cultural wellness practice involves providing free end-of-life doula training to Indigenous people. Right now, we're discussing her story growing up and how it informs her work. Only insofar as, you know, is comfortable and you're willing to share, is there any part of that time that you spent living on the street that you would maybe, anything you would want to tell people who have no window into that world or who have never experienced that?
Yeah, it was in a lot of ways that time for myself. I went out onto the streets in a way that was kind of invisible homelessness. So I did a lot of couch surfing. You know, I would maybe have a nice uncle who'd invite me to stay for a month here, or a friend's mother who would invite me to spend Christmas so I wasn't, you know, out in the cold in Thunder Bay in the winter, you know, or if I was waiting to relocate where I did have some housing. I had a lot of, I guess, people who kind of were really generous in that I was a 17-year-old girl trying to be safe. And they recognized that. So I had some really awesome, like an English homeroom teacher who, you know, even though I had nowhere to go, I was still trying to finish my semester and get my credits to graduate. And she saw that I didn't have a winter coat, so she brought me a winter coat to wear, which was really great in Thunder Bay in the winter. very necessary. And I think, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is there are so many more hidden homeless than the visible. And there's quite a few visibly homeless people now, houseless people. And it is really... the bigger picture is that it's not going to get better. It's just going to get worse with the way things are going. So for myself in those days, I come from a parents who divorced. So I did the ping ponging back and forth between those two homes, trying to get along with people, getting along with my parents, I've referred to it as a high conflict relationship with my parents in the past. And what people don't really understand about street life, particularly when it comes to being a young person out there, there is a really strong sense of camaraderie. There's a strong sense of looking out for each other. It was very common to meet people who had run away from group homes, people who had left family situations because they had come out and weren't accepted, people who, you know, were escaping really bad situations. And so you get out into these streets, you meet in places like youth drop-ins where you get hot meals and showers and things like that. And you connect with each other because you're still kids. You're still, you know, looking for friends. You're still trying to have some kind of a semblance of what someone your age would do. And so for my group of friends, we really looked out for each other. If somebody, you know, met up with their aunt for dinner and she bought them new clothes for the season kind of thing, a new jacket, new shoes, and left that person with maybe $200 to get some groceries and stuff like that, that kid would come back to the group and we'd all have that $200. We'd all, you know, we'd all enjoy the toilet paper they bought. And one person got an apartment and they'd offer the group a place to stay. And, you know, it was just, we watched out for each other. We were a family. And there's a really strong sense of right and wrong. You know, you don't, I remember I had some friends who used to panhandle and fly a sign, you would call it. And, you know, you'd stand with a sign at an intersection or something like that, or you'd be in like a, on a sidewalk, you know, panhandling with a sign. And there was really strong rules that people felt, like you don't ask people with children for money. You don't ask people who are obviously, you know, not as well off, like they're in the same boat, maybe financially, you don't have a lot of money. There was absolutely rules around who you would and would not approach. And then there was also a lot of nonverbal ways that we looked out for each other. It's super common for some nice person to come up in those in situations where you're panhandling or something like that. And they say, oh, you know, let me take you out for dinner and you must be hungry. So, of course, you'd take those opportunities. But in a lot of those situations, those were moments of exploitation and extraction. They were going to pay for your dinner, but they wanted to hear about your story. They wanted to know why you were out on the streets. They wanted to know what happened to you. And so a lot of a few people went through this. And after a while, like, you know, it does become extractive. And it's like, you're a stranger. I don't want to tell you my traumas because you bought me a hamburger. You know, and people would even go as far as to say, well, come back to my apartment. You can sleep on my couch. And some people would take this up. Other people felt like, absolutely not, that's not safe. And, you know, some folks, some kids would lie, you know, just to get that meal and get out of there. Make stuff up because it is something like, I'm going to help you, but you're going to give me something in return. There's a lot of that. And it's very similar to that performative kind of allyship or white, you know, saviorism. There's an element of them doing that for themselves. And when we think about coping in crisis and things like that, we hear a lot of fight or flight, but we don't hear much about the fawning or the tending and befriending. And so when people are feeling like they're in crisis, their first instinct might actually be to assuage the person, give them what they want, you know, be non-threatening and extract yourself ASAP.
This is People First Radio. My guest is Crystal Toop. She's an end-of-life doula and the founder of Blackbird Medicines. Right now, she's speaking about her experience of homelessness in Ontario in the 1990s.
So there was a lot of ways that, as young people, we were able to instantly assess whether a person was safe or not. Sometimes you're wrong. We learned to keep an eye out for each other. If you saw someone, you know, this is in the 90s, before everybody and their cat had a cell phone, you had to use pay phones and find quarters to call people. You knew which pay phones you could call and find somebody. You know, I remember With the internet, there was a few friends who had, you know, maybe tried to go back to live in their community and things like that. And they'd get lonely for the friends and the family that we had created, this family group that we created. And you could actually see people on the stoplight cameras online. So they would look at the stoplight cameras from a certain intersection that they knew they could see people, and they'd, oh, they're so-and-so, and they'd miss them, and little interesting things like that. But we definitely had a way of looking out for each other and protecting each other. And also there's lots of times that we collaborated with police. We worked with, you know, law enforcement to, you know, return a runaway who was 12 years old and hiding out on the streets, or, you know, helping find someone that had come down to basically become, you know, a sexual tourist kind of thing. So there's a lot of, there's just so much there, you know, so many stories. I think, well, one of the stories I talk about when I do this public speaking stuff is about a young lady who was also Indigenous, and I think she was about 18 or 19, but she had met a guy. They liked each other, and they went for a walk. And he actually really violently assaulted her and killed her. And so I, at the time, was 21, and I had a toddler. And I was, I removed myself from street life to a degree where I had a home that I lived at and my bed to go to every night and good things like that. But I was working. I was working downtown with street kids to help them. I'd been hired in a peer capacity to do outreach. I was doing public speaking for some youth nonprofits about the dangers of street life and the realities to different schools and things like that. So here I am still kind of, you know, seeing the same people I saw every day as a street kid. And here's this young lady who, you know, she's not a street kid, but she's street involved, as they say. She had street kid friends. And I was really aware as a 21-year-old, you know, young single mother, I was really aware of the way the media blamed her for that death, blamed her. You know, they brought up that she had been known to smoke pot, and they brought up that, you know, she had been known to frequent Rideau Street. Well, Rideau Street's where you catch buses also. Like, it's a whole community down there in the ecosystem. But they just continuously blamed her as an Indigenous woman. And myself, being an Indigenous woman, and, you know, it's not an unheard of thing to meet someone and you click and you go for a walk or a coffee or something. So she really didn't do anything that I myself hadn't done. And I was so cognizant of how that led to her demise, and then society blamed her. So that was something that was really jarring to me and painful to the mutual friends that we had, to see the media continuously try to find reasons to justify her death. So yeah, that's one of the things I got out of one of the big experiences that really stayed with me. It wasn't long after my grandmother had died that this had unfolded. And, you know, I remember at one point I had accepted a ride with this group of kids that I had just met. And we were going to drive to another city where they had come from, Cornwall, like an hour from Ottawa. And I had this terrible moment of realization driving on the highway that nobody knew where I was. No, you know, I didn't have the cell phone. It was 98. And, you know, nobody knew that I was with these people. And if I never came back, you know, nobody was going to really know about that. So I just had this moment hit me. And this was just before I became a mom, but it was like, I could actually disappear. And, you know, I got into this car. I'm in the back seat. I'm not driving. Anything could happen to me. So very real moments that, you know, you're almost confronted with your own mortality and the risks that we were living in.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and my guest on today's show is Crystal Toop. She's the founder of Blackbird Medicines, a plant and land-based spiritual and cultural wellness practice. One of their main focuses is offering an Indigenous death doula mentorship program. You talked there about times when people really helped you out. For example, your English teacher giving you a coat. And you also mentioned times when people who initially seemed like they wanted to help folks out ended up being kind of extractive, you know, like, tell me your whole story as I buy you a hamburger. What would you say to folks to kind of navigate that line of like wanting to help without causing more harm and making sure that it's not something they're doing for themselves rather than a person?
Well, the reality is that we have a lot of services now for folks who are street engaged. That is probably the least, you know, least hassle that the person's going to, you know, it's easy enough to have a donation drive that you hand off to service providers who do that outreach. I also know several people who have made it their annual tradition because they have that background of street life, where, you know, every Christmas or something, they load up their car and they go around and they hand things out. They look for folks who are sleeping outside and they hand it out. That's okay. That's okay to do that. But it's where you expect something in return, like their time, their attention. That's not what giving is. You don't give because you're expecting to get. And that's gifting 101. You know, that there's definitely folks who need help, and what their whys for being in that situation are really not your business. It's one thing if you're, you know, in some kind of helping capacity and they've come to you for that support or advice or guidance. But when you're looking to support people on the streets, there are so, so many ways to do it. One I like to tell folks about is Operation Come Home. And they have been in helping youth who are made homeless, or, you know, they're stuck, they're kicked out, something like that. They've been helping youth since the 70s. When I was 17 and homeless in Thunder Bay, they traveled me back to where I had a place to stay in Ottawa. And they run so many programs, employment, satellite high school, you know, Red Seal, kind of like placement trade stuff, like you name it. They're a national organization, and there's many organizations that have just done so much work to support youth. And they're not these big bloated multi-corporate office, you know, giant tree of org flowchart type stuff. This is, you know, these are people, like five people in the office, and they are the top, and they do the things themselves. So, you know, maybe you don't have those sorts of organizations if you're in a more rural space or something like that. But there's ways that you can help, and it's about paying attention. You know, we have a lady in my community here. We have limited supports for folks who are street engaged. And she does an annual winter coat drive just on her own. She doesn't, it's not a big fuss, but she's got arrangements with several small businesses where she sets up a coat rack in a very accessible place. And these folks can just help themselves to a coat, hats, mittens. They don't have to talk to anybody. It's up to them. So really, when you're removed from the equation, you know, as to how that person's accessing that help, it's about making it easier for them, not feeling, you know, rainbows in yourself.
Talking about death education, you mentioned that there was a time when your grandparents passed away, and that was something that you maybe didn't feel like you were able to properly deal with or process until many years later. That's also something, speaking with Susan, that she experienced and that she sees in a lot of her students. Is there anything that you would say or offer to maybe young people, or reflections on managing those kind of early experiences of death and kind of mitigating the inevitable negative effects?
I think the biggest thing we can do, whether we're people who teach young people or young people ourselves, learn about the different types of grief. That is such an important teaching that we're not given inherently. I wouldn't even really say that it was something that historically we did when we had a different relationship with death. Learning about the different types of grief can really help you to navigate that grief and loss. And also understanding that there's no right way to grieve. We've all seen the sitcom episodes and the movies that talk about, you know, the stages, and they move through these stages in a really specific way, and it's ordered, and it's just not like that. And it was never those stages were never intended to be processed in like that orderly way. It's grief is messy, and it actually, for the most part, never actually ends. Grief, you know, like I have days where I miss my grandmother so much, and it's like she died yesterday for how painful it is. And understanding that grief doesn't fade or go away, people feel a little kind of broken when they hear that. But when we understand the different types of grief and how we carry and express and deal with them, can help us to manage living with grief better. And that part, that's how it becomes easier. So for when my grandmother died, she'd had a 5-year battle with cancer. She'd had cancer. She was in remission. She did great. Then they checked on her. It flared up all over. And that's when she became terminal. And with that outset of learning about her cancer, I had a certain amount of denial. I was like, good luck for cancer. They're not going to take my grandma down. She was a tough lady. And so there was almost this kind of complicated grief where I didn't really let it all sink in because I didn't think I had to. And when you find out that the cancer comes back, then you might experience something like anticipatory grief, where it's kind of this thing where you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, yes, she's sick and she's declining, but how much longer do I have? And it's something that people who love folks that, misuse substances, that's something really familiar to them. You know, maybe you've kind of made peace with that. They're deep in this addiction. They're not the same person that I know. They're a person with a layer of addiction over their life. And I've heard this many times because I've also experienced it. There's a point where you make peace that you're waiting for that call to hear that they've overdosed. So this anticipatory grief, it's complicated grief because maybe in a way you've already mourned their death. And when they die, you're not hit with the same grief because you've already to a degree made peace with that. That's something that's going to happen. So there's so many facets of grief. And when you just start to learn about some of them, it does help you cope a little bit better. And we can experience grief through any change, any transition, starting a new school, moving, getting a new job, getting fired. Your adult child is going to become a parent and you grieve, you know, the loss of their childhood. And, you know, that stage of being their mother is over and now you're their grandmother or something. Like there's just so many ways that grief impact our lives. And when we start to really support each other and understanding that, I think you just see people kind of like clear up a little bit, like the fog lifts when they understand that, you know, it's okay. Whatever you're feeling is okay.
This is People First Radio. I'm speaking with Crystal Toop. She founded the cultural wellness practice Blackbird Medicines. We've been talking about her journey leading up to her work as an end-of-life doula. She now offers free death doula training to Indigenous people in Ontario. When you say when we support each other in understanding that grief, what can that look like?
Oh, well, for myself, just kind of using that example about folks who misuse substances, you know, my children's father, he is someone who was scooped in the through child welfare from his First Nation in Saskatchewan, and he has had substance abuse issues his whole life. So to support my kids with that reality, because there came a point where we had to, you know, cut them out of our lives, and now they're becoming young adults, and there's this kind of question of, you know, do I want to reconnect with him in any way? Supporting them through that, you know, can look like letting them feel their feelings, letting them talk about it, not judging them. You know, I have one kid who's open, one kid who's angry. You know, these are totally natural feelings, and helping them feel empowered of what they want to do. But with folks who misuse substances, the people that love them, they suffer, and there's a level of grief there that is hard to explain if you haven't experienced it. And talking and relating to someone else who's been through that or who understands that type of grief and loss, that itself is support and a balm to that pain. So just knowing the difficulties that some parents experience when your child has addiction struggles. And, you know, recently we had a family that their adult son passed away from overdose, and they've been struggling for years trying to get them help and, you know, two steps forward, five steps back sort of thing. And once that loved one overdoses, like you were afraid of, there's almost relief. And that's complicated grief, because at least they're not suffering anymore. They're not in danger. They're not, you know, the worst has happened. You know, there's no more other shoe to drop. It's dropped. So just relating to people around those very real experiences, it's something that is the support, you know, having someone to talk to that's been through it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that idea was just Remembrance Day, and I was reading through this testimonial of soldiers who were in the Second World War that they kind of wrote in 2002, and a big theme that kept coming up was that this was a very traumatic experience, and they could only really feel like talking with other people who had been through the same thing was like the only thing that would help them, a lot of them kept saying, basically. And it sounds like what you're describing there is maybe pretty similar.
Absolutely. That's why support groups work when it comes to these types of challenges. Being in a space where others are coming to that space in a similar mind frame, in a similar angst and grief, this is where people really start to feel heard and seen. And like we've said, complicated a couple of times now, but it is complicated. And you sometimes don't feel safe talking to folks who don't understand, because you might feel judged. And that's the last thing you want to feel when you're trying to work through something.
That brings us nicely to some of the work you do, right? Like, this is how you fill your time, is supporting people through dealing with some of the different challenges that life throws at us, right?
Yeah. I've been working as a death doula since 2018. And I started out as a birth doula in 2015. When I was training as a birth doula, it was an Indigenous specific program in partnership with Dona International. And within that kind of birth training, the idea of full spectrum or life spectrum doula care was introduced, which is helping and caring for people throughout the spectrum of life, not just pregnancy and childbirth related. And in that training, they touched on death doula work and how that comes into play with prenatal, postnatal, you know, infertility loss, miscarriage, stillbirth, abortion, you know, how on that spectrum you can support people with loss and grief. And it was a very small kind of like touchdown and onto the next unit. And I remember thinking like, whoa, 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 like, let's go back to that. And I didn't really get that chance. So I started looking into it more. And a lot of what I was doing as a death doula, another area that was introduced in that training was harm reduction. And how can we reduce harm in that particular training, it was, you know, if you're working with someone who is expecting a baby and maybe they're using substances or they're trying to cut back on using substances, whether that's alcohol, drugs, tobacco, maybe they have gestational diabetes and they need to change their diet, there's still elements of harm reduction that you can support there. And in my time doing birth work, I was trying to reduce harm for new moms. And more often than I wanted, it was getting in between child welfare apprehensions of newborns at the hospital. And that just was really hard on my spirit. And I wasn't supported the way I needed to be supported to do that work. And that's something that comes up a lot when you're this doula or helper person, whether you're a counselor, crisis worker, whatever, you need support for yourself to do this work. And that is because of the lateral impacts, or sorry, the vicarious impacts of what people are going through. You know, you're kind of like this sponge out there helping people. And if you absorb all this pain and fear and anguish, you have to let go of that at some point. So I was doing that work. And around this time, my grandfather had been diagnosed with his cancer. And he was struggling a lot with chemo hands and feet. When you go through chemotherapy, you can experience a numbness. You know, his fingers and toes are always really cold. And so I started to look into, I was very interested in plant medicine, traditional uses of plants. And he, as my grandpa, had a lot of knowledge that I wasn't aware of. And it started to come up in our conversations. And in, around that time, I also learned, you know, I had to ask him very direct questions. My nickname for him was always the crusty Algonquin because he was kind of like perpetually in a bad mood. So this is why we didn't have a lot of information. It was a little prickly. So I was asking him specific questions, and that's what I learned about our residential school history, that both of his parents had attended. His own father had been a veteran. He was a World War II tank gunner. And so he survived. His father survived residential school, signed up, went to the military, went to war, got, you know, shot, came back, and had, you know, 8 kids right away, and then died not much long after. So getting all of these stories from my grandpa and trying to find plant medicines to help him, it really kept pulling me towards that death doula work. And before long, I was kind of in demand.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm speaking with Crystal Toop. We're discussing her journey into end-of-life doula work and offering end-of-life doula training to Indigenous people through her cultural wellness practice, Blackbird Medicines.
And so by the time 2018 came around, I was like, well, I'm just going to be a death doula this year, an apprentice. I'll call it my apprentice here. And I started just trying to learn and volunteer and experience as much as I could. And by, 2019, I was like rebranding, as they say, in the game. And, I relaunched, and it was really just special timing because, you know, it was all right before the pandemic unfolded and the pandemic hit, and I was swamped with requests for support. Often it was counseling, one-on-one counseling. Often I was talking with people who their loved one was dying. They're experiencing grief over infertility, people who were transitioning into methadone programs while they were pregnant, trying to reduce harm in ways that were practical to each person. And the pandemic hit and I couldn't handle it. I needed to ask some people that were my mentors to step in and support me because I had moved out of the city of Ottawa. I was relocated to live with my partner, and the requests were so many. I was able to just send them to these two. One's a crisis worker, one is a counselor and also a doula and things like that. So I had the confidence in these two kind of peers of mine that, you know, I can't help this person because I'm not, you know, I don't have the proximity and things like that. And I didn't have the resources because a lot of this was being done for free as well. And so we started as a, we made a little collective, the Indigenous Death Doula Collective. And I used that to apply for some smaller grants, 5,000 here, 7,500 here. And we were disseminating care packages for youth during the pandemic. And things like traditional medicines, art supplies, hygiene supplies, cleaning supplies, grocery cards, that kind of stuff. The stuff that, you know, sort of everybody was doing, but we were doing it specifically for folks who were coping with death and dying and loss. And at the same time that we're offering, you know, these care packages, people from across the world are reaching out to me in my email and saying, we want to learn how to be death doulas. And do you have a training? Do you have this? Do you have that? So I got another little grant and offered a youth mentorship for free. And it was a really basic kind of thing, a couple of Zoom meetings just like this, where I talked with folks, and so many people came with their own experiences, their own, you know, their own losses that they'd helped. Some of them came in with multiple people who had died very recently, and it was just kind of empowering them and, you know, showing them resources that I had found helpful. And, you know, it just seemed so basic, but it blew up, and we had a wait list of 200 people, and we were able to mentor 35 youth. So, but the mentorship call out got shared on CBC. And so, yeah, we had this massive wait list of not only youth who wanted a training to take to be able to do the work in their communities, for their families, for themselves. And it's kind of been like, never look back. It's just been snowballing steadily, bigger and bigger all the time. But so I've, in the last little while, I still do one-on-one counseling. We still run a group support, but I've moved away a bit from offering that doula care personally outside of the counseling. Because I'm so busy with training lots and lots of people. So it's been amazing to meet so many wonderful people. And yeah, wow. It's been fire, basically.
Earlier you were talking about, you know, if you're someone who's doing this work, then you're going to be helping people confront their pain, but also maybe absorbing some of that pain and that grief. And, you know, you need to do something to take care of yourself. I was just wondering, is that something that you've found a way to deal with? Is that maybe less of an issue now that you're like a step removed and training more people?
Well, I think it just gets easier with practice regardless. It does help that I'm not kind of up to my eyeballs in it, that's for sure. And at the outset, it just felt like there was so many folks that, you know, I wanted to connect with. And you're almost hard on yourself because you can't physically do everything that everybody wants you to do. So yeah, it does become emotionally, physically, the whole shebang, just holistically draining. And I started during the pandemic, I was you know, just taking small little, you know, country drives with my partner and you know, doing a little animal photography and, you know, just kind of taking a moment to detach and do something different, get outside, that kind of stuff. And since, you know, we've kind of returned to some sort of version of normal, you know, I regularly, you know, have monthly things that I do for myself. And sometimes it's a struggle to get them done. Like, I'll, you know, I go to the local salon, the local Steel Magnolia spot, and, you know, take a moment, get a facial and maybe, you know, a pedicure and chat and laugh and that kind of thing. And my partner and I love to travel. So sometimes it's a weekend trip, sometimes it's a day road trip, but definitely having good people you can talk to when you notice that you're carrying some of these things. You know, especially with, as someone who's done social justice work for a long time, it can be really hard to be so open to what's going on in the world. And, you know, death work does really heavily collide with social injustice. And there's times where, you know, like what's going on overseas and what, you know, what happened with the wildfires and Hawaii and like all these things, it just, you know, land defender situations, you know, you do have to kind of almost shut down. And mentally I'm picturing a flower that just goes whoop. And, you know, just take care of yourself and try not to let all of that in for a moment so you can rest yourself mentally and spiritually. Yeah. So makes a difference.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring to the conversation today?
If you're Indigenous, First Nation, Inuit, Métis, Black, person of the global majority, or some kind of combination of all the above, whatever those, you know, identities might comprise, we do have a free training until December 2024 that people can register for free. We have a grant from Ontario Trillium Foundation, and we're trying to train as many people as possible who are interested in this work. It's not a tested kind of like exam heavy sort of thing. It is very much about cultivating a connection and a learning journey that's unique to yourself. And so just an open invitation that I'd like to share to folks who have that identity. They're interested, like I said before, for yourself, for your family. If you're thinking you might want to do this as a career, whatever your motivations are, to please sign up. We had a goal of training 200, the wait list. We're going to train the wait list of 200 people in the 4-year life of this grant. And in the first year, we've trained 376 since it's been launched. So I would kind of like to blow the roof off those numbers as much as possible and train as many folks who want the training.
If someone's interested in that training, what's the website they need to go to? What are the search terms they need to use?
Well, you can check out my website, blackbirdmedicines.ca. And of course, Instagram, Facebook, Blackbird Medicines is all over those. And there's training links to apply for free. And yeah, it's fairly, you can Google it. I think it'll come up. I don't know. Yeah, absolutely. The website's always a good spot to start.
Well, Crystal, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time and your story today.
Oh, Chimigwech, thank you for sharing this time and the invite. It was so lovely to talk with you and to get to meet you.
Crystal Toop is the owner and founder of Blackbird Medicines.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Next week on the program, we're going to be wrapping up what's become a bit of a series looking at death and dying. We'll check in on Vancouver Island University's new end-of-life doula course that's created and run by Carmen Lavoie. Speaking with her, I learned about this really interesting thing that's helping some people with their grief. It's called a phone of the wind. I'll let Lavoie explain.
So it's an idea originated in Japan after the tsunami, where a gentleman put a phone in a phone booth in his garden, and he would go into that phone booth and use the phone whenever he needed to connect with his wife who had died in the tsunami. The phone's not actually connected, so it's not working in the conventional sense, but he found that it was useful as a way to help him bridge the divide between the living and the dead. And then his neighbors asked if they could start using this phone, and then people from other parts of town, and then people from other towns started to come and use this phone in his garden. And so the idea has kind of spread now to like other parts of the world, including North America, that it would just place a phone in a private place, ideally in nature, that's not connected to, you know, phone lines in the traditional sense, or, you know, Wi-Fi or data or anything like that. It's a phone. And there's a little explanation about its role there, which is to support people having conversations with those who have died, to share those things that they weren't able to share with that person when they were alive, to share sentiment, to share what's happening for them now since that person's passed. So it could be used in a multitude of ways, but it just kind of enables people to make that connection that otherwise they might feel is removed from their day-to-day life.
It's interesting, eh? The idea of like a physical symbol that allows you to make that connection that might otherwise feel weird to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's why, you know, it's helpful if it's located somewhere quasi-private, if not very private, just because people might feel suspect of talking out loud. But the freedom that comes with that opportunity, I think we see has immense benefit for people just to work through some of their grief.
Also coming up on the program, the BC Humanist Foundation has recently come out with a new free guide designed to help non-religious people navigate everything that comes with the end-of-life experience. The guide doesn't only focus on what might first come into our minds when we hear the words end-of-life. It also includes a section about death and toxic drug poisoning. Here's BC Humanist Association Executive Director and co-author of the guide, Ian Bushfield, to explain.
So this is a section I really expanded. Our initial guide was a pamphlet, a shorter version that touched on a number of different aspects. And it was published during the early part of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we had a section in there on death during COVID, on the challenges that raises. And as I was thinking, as we were thinking about rewriting this and expanding it to an ebook, I was realizing we're in the midst of so many overlapping crises that need to be addressed. So COVID is definitely one of the challenges where so many of us have come face to face with the fact that death is more prevalent than I think we wanted to acknowledge and impacted so many people. You know, 50,000 people in Canada have lost their lives of COVID-19, and we don't talk about that very much anymore, even though they're still dying. The other crises we're facing in BC are the toxic drug overdose crisis and climate change. In terms of toxic drugs, 12,000 or more people have died from that, six a day. You know, by the time your listeners will have heard this, it will be more, which is tragic. And many of these people in particular are younger men, which is not the group that typically dies as much, right? When we think about conversations about death, we're usually thinking of people who are older after retirement and who've lived a full life, so to speak. But with the toxic drug crisis, one use of drugs could be your last. And that changes the rubric so much. And starting to think around that and conceptualize what that means. In terms of humanism, you know, we've talked in some of our other advocacy around how there needs to be a more compassionate and evidence-based approach to this. A lot of the push for tackling this crisis from the province comes on, well, we just need more recovery beds, but what does that do if the first time you take drugs, you die, right? I think your listeners are probably well acquainted with that. And even beyond that, we also like to point out that a lot of the approaches we have to recovery are based on kind of these moralistic 12-step frameworks that just require you to admit to a higher power. But many people don't believe in that. And so we push back on that. And, you know, that didn't all make it into this guide because there's so much more we could say. But we do suggest people think about some of these challenges, learn about how they can at least help those in their community, check in on your neighbors, learn how to use a naloxone kit and those kind of things.
Also coming soon on People First Radio, Kelsey Kalana says that in times of crisis like wildfires, sometimes the media's efforts to capture a story can cause further harm to people already going through difficult situations. She's created a new media kit designed to help both people who might be approached by the media and media members who might be assigned to work in difficult situations. As we'll hear in this preview, there's also a third group of people involved in any story. I'm wondering, though, about maybe the biggest group of people in all of this, people who consume media. What do you think they need to be aware of about this conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, just understanding that as consumers of media, that, you know, those narratives that are attached to it comes at a cost for a lot of people, especially Indigenous people. When I was reporting with Indigenews and the uncovering of the 215 children happened of my relatives in Tikamus Tishiquetmik, in what's been briefly known as Kamloops, that was when I really seen how consumerism drove a lot of how these stories were told. And people really wanted those stories. They wanted to know more about what happened. They wanted they yearned to attach themselves to the story. And that's a beautiful thing, because as humans, we are empathetic people. We're compassionate as human beings. And so I really told the media at the time on, you know, like I took to Twitter instantly, because I was just angry to watch how these practices were happening. And I said, like, there's the TRC is out there. There's over 600 stories in that report. Why are we having to go and extract all of these right now during our grief ceremony? That is absolutely irresponsible. Also, that really impacts people's well-beings as they're watching it, because there is such thing as, you know, that trauma that if we witness trauma, then it actually is our body experiencing it. And that's why it's almost a form of self-harm. And we say that, like, it is a form of self-harm to intake stories that are traumatic and to sensationalize those stories, because it's like, oh, I want to know what happened. Like, it's so bad, but I don't want to look away. And, you know, and it's just like being compassionate that these are real, and you might see them, you know, written in written form. You might see them broadcasted, but this is real.
Kelsey Kalana speaking about a new media kit designed to help avoid harm when reporting on communities in crisis. Stay tuned to hear the full conversation on an upcoming episode. That is it for now, though. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. A reminder to check out our podcast feed. If you listen, subscribe, rate us there, you can help us reach a broader audience. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.